Okay, so I'm not going to waste a lot of time introducing these two folks because I think if you've been around a little bit, you know them probably. John Walton, who will be our first speaker, is going to speak on Genesis 1, something he has done a lot of speaking and writing about, a couple of books, lots of articles, some videos, and really has some very fresh perspectives for those of us who may have grown up with kind of a limited view of what Genesis 1 means. He's going to unpack some of the theology related to God's vision statement for the cosmos in Genesis chapter 1. And I'm going to play the mean moderator. I'm going to give them each 25 minutes, and so when the 25-minute timer rolls around, I'm just going to look at it on my watch. I'm going to stand up and I'm going to shake my finger at John and indicate that he should be wrapping it up real quickly. And then without further ado, we're going to hand it off to Robert Bishop, who is our resident physicist and philosopher of science. I don't know, philosopher, historian of science, is that accurate? He wears a lot of hats. But Robert is going to speak to us about the doctrine of creation and how that informs scientific inquiry as a way of knowing. So I will hand it over to those two gentlemen in just a moment, but before I do that, let me ask God's blessing on our time tonight. So if you would pause and pray with me. Father, we thank you for this place. We thank you for this institution where your name is revered and we can gather together as brothers and sisters who take seriously your general revelation in creation. God, we thank you for the ASA and the people who have gone before to make this such a strong organization. We ask that you would help us to take that seriously and to give our aid wherever possible to this organization. God, thanks for John Walton and Robert Bishop who are going to speak with us tonight about these important topics. God, we thank you and we ask for your blessing on this evening in the name of our Savior, Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Oh, and by the way, we're going to have a question and answer period, but we'll save that for the very end of the session. So store up your questions for John and write those down because we won't get a chance to ask the questions until after Robert has spoken.
All right. Well, good evening. Good to see you all. I better talk fast. So, we're here in part to talk about the book that's coming out in just 2 months or so.
December 4th.
December 4th.
That's right.
Yes. And, there are five of us that have taught a Theories of Origins class here for over 20 years now. And finally, we've put all our heads together and put our material into a textbook. So there's five of us writing, Robert Bishop and Larry Funk is here, and Ray Lewis is on sabbatical, Steve Mosher, and then myself. So we cover the various sciences, and then I write the Bible and theology stuff all through it, so that we can get that integrative element all through. This is a legitimate textbook. It's going to look like a textbook, feel like a textbook, read better than a textbook. But anyway, so that's coming out. And so part of what we're doing tonight is introducing some of the material of this book. So they've asked me to talk about Genesis 1, and I call it God's vision statement for the cosmos. I always start out by talking about how we ought to be reading the biblical text. And my position is that we need to read it within its cultural environment. I call it its cultural river. I believe that we need to do it this way if we're going to get the authoritative message of the text. God delivered the message of the text to authors in a time, in a place, in a language, in a culture. And if we want to get that authoritative message of God, we have to get into that audience and hear it the way they would have heard it. So that's what I call the cultural river. To understand the cultural river, we can start with our own modern cultural river. And some words are coming up on the screen that define a little bit of our cultural river. It involves politics, economics, values, science, and lots of other things that all help us to define what our culture is like, what the parameters are, and how we think. Some of these things we are very comfortable with. Other things, we don't like at all. But whether we're floating gently on the currents of the cultural river, or whether we're swimming furiously upstream, trying to argue against it and resist it, we know this river. This is who we are. And it's how we think, and it's how we interact. The discourse of our culture takes place in this kind of framework. And we could put dozens of more words up there. You get the idea. The main point I want to make is that the biblical writers have no knowledge of this cultural river. How would they? We don't expect to open up Proverbs to read something about social media. And we shouldn't expect to open up Psalms and read something about the expanding universe. These are not part of the biblical ancient cultural river. And we shouldn't expect the Bible to address these. The Bible is written for us, but it's not written to us. Some of you are watching your watches to figure out how long it would take me to say that line. Okay? There it is. Okay? So it's not written to us. And therefore, we have to do some work to get into that context. So this is our cultural river. And the biblical authors do not know it. They don't write to it. And so we really can't expect the Bible to address it. It addresses us who are in a cultural river, but it doesn't address the cultural river itself. Okay? So, instead, of course, it operates within its own cultural river. And God chose to communicate to the Israelites in their language, in their culture, and in their cultural river. And so we can start to see some of the words coming up on the screen that define a little bit about their cultural river. These are ideas that are pretty much foreign to us. We don't understand them intuitively. We would find it difficult to penetrate this world and all that is meant. But again, these are the things that the biblical audience knows well. The Israelites know this river. And some of these things, again, they were perfectly content to float along, and God had no problem with that. Other things, God said, no, resist that one. But even when they're resisting it, just like ours, even when you resist it, it's still the world of discourse. It's the conversations that take place. This is the room for conversation, whether you're agreeing or disagreeing. This is the world that Israel knew. This is the world that's behind the biblical text. And so we need to read the biblical text in connection to this world, not ours. That's if we want to give credence to the authority of the text. We are accountable to the biblical authors. That's how the authority works. It's God's authority. He vested it in those authors. And if we want to get that authoritative message, we're accountable to those authors. And that means we have to leave our cultural river behind, hard as that is, and try to understand their cultural river. So, that's a very brief presentation of that overview. Now, the proposed thesis, what are we talking about? When we apply these ideas to trying to understand Genesis 1, we have to think about what kind of creation story are they telling? Do they think about creation the same way we do? We could talk about the idea that creation means to bring something from non-existence to existence. Great. What do you mean by existence? You say, well, everybody has the same idea about existence. No, they don't. No, they don't. Cultural rivers make a difference. They think about existence differently than we do. I don't have time to prove that tonight, but I can do that, but not tonight. So, when we think about what kind of story they're telling, what do they think about when they think about creation? We find out that what's at the top of their values list in the ancient world, biblical and not biblical, top of the values list is order. Bringing about order, whether it's in society or whether it's in the cosmos. That's what's most important. So, when they tell the creation story, they're telling a story about how God brought order to the cosmos. Now, let's think about this idea for a moment. We often think of the world in binary terms, good and evil. And we try to classify things into those categories, good and evil. But we often find ourselves in a mix, in a mess. What about a tornado? Is that good or evil? Well, it's hard to say that it's either one of those things. I propose that in the ancient world, they tended to think in trinary terms, not binary terms. It's not just good, evil, okay? It's order, non-order, and disorder. For them, the world begins with non-order, okay? Non-order is the default, and it ultimately is also the undesirable state. Think about when you're moving into a new house. You've got all the boxes piled around, and you've got all the furniture lumped together in one corner. It's non-order. It's not evil, but it's undesirable. It's not what it should be. It's not going to allow you to live your lives in an ordered situation. So you have to work at ordering that world, unpacking the boxes, arranging the furniture, filling the cupboards, filling the closets, and ordering that space so that you can then dwell in it. And then your home exists. When it is ordered to fulfill the purpose that you have for your home. So non-order is a default, but ultimately undesirable. Order is established in the ancient world by the gods, or by humans delegated to that task by the gods. When God creates us in his image in Genesis 1, he is creating us to work alongside him in the ordering process. And we see that in verbs like subdue and rule, order bringing. God brings order to the cosmos, but not total order, optimal order, and then people will work alongside him to continue that order bringing process. Order cannot be sustained independently of active agency. If you just leave it alone, it's going to get worse. Okay? If you walk in the house every day and just throw your clothes on the floor, right? If you don't sustain order, non-order results. Not necessarily disorder. Again, non-order is not evil. But order cannot be sustained unless you've got active agency maintaining it. And that's true of the cosmos as well. God is actively involved in maintaining order. Disorder is what happens when someone disrupts the order that someone else is actively working to establish. Okay, so the boxes piled there before you unpack them is not evil, it's non-order, it needs ordering. But if somebody gets into your house and trashes it, that's disorder, working against the order that you sought to establish. Disorder in the human world occurs when humans undermine the order that's being sustained by the gods. We call that the fall. We call it sin. That's the form that disorder takes in Genesis chapter 3. So we have beginning non-order. That's Genesis 1-2. Tohu vavohu, formless and void. Now, non-order, that's what that phrase refers to. Non-order, then God baraz, creates to bring about order, and then that's disrupted in chapter 3 by disorder. And the penalty for disorder is non-order, which happens with the flood. Non-order returns because of the disorder. That's just a little bit of glimpse into this trinary system, the way to think about the world in a little bit different terms, trying to capture the way they would have thought about the world in ancient times. So, what would be the claims of Genesis 1? That's what I'm always trying to figure out. I want to know what the biblical claims are, because lots of people feel that the Bible's claims are conflicting with science's claims. That science has certain theories and ideas and principles and premises and all of this, and the Bible's claims are conflicting with that. Well, they could be, but before we could make a judgment on that, we have to know what the Bible's claims are. And that's my job. My job is not to assess the science and what science's claims are. My job is to assess the Bible's claims. And the Bible's claims, in the language in which it's written,
in the literary style and genre in which it's written, and in the cultural context in which it's written. That's how we go about trying to understand the Bible's claims. So, as I talk about Genesis 1, I talk about God establishing role and purpose in an ordered system. That's what it means to create in the ancient world. To establish role and purpose in an ordered system. That's what the creation act is. In that sense, what we have in Genesis 1 is not really an account of cosmic origins, but an account of cosmic identity. Now, the reason I make that distinction is that in our cultural river, when we talk about cosmic origins, our brains flash immediately to science and to physics, with all apologies, to physics, and it's how our minds think in our day and age, in our modern world. But that's not how they thought in the ancient world. They've got no physics. They've got none of these sciences. So when they think of origins, they're not thinking science. When they think about what we call cosmic origins, they're thinking about what the cosmos is. Cosmic identity. What its purpose is and God, what God ordered it to do. That's an identity question. So, a vision statement for the cosmos. That's what I named the talk tonight. So, in the ancient world, they didn't talk about vision statements, but we do a lot in our cultural river. Matter of fact, I teach in the grad school, and the grad school's been around about 70 years or so. And a couple years ago, when the college was talking about kind of raising the profile of the grad school, and we're looking at some of the documents, they said, wait a minute, hold it. We don't have a vision statement for the grad school. What do you mean? How can you not have a vision statement? I mean, you don't exist if you don't have a vision statement.
We need to get us a vision statement.
So, you know how it goes. Committees and meetings and all of this kind of thing. Wordsmithing and how to get the top 38 different important items into a 14-word vision statement. Yeah, okay, right? And so we work on it for a year and a half, you know, and it has to go up the hill, you know, to the administration, back down, change again, revise this, add this, and this committee. Finally, after a year and a half, okay, vote, yes, we got it? Everybody agree? Yes, we've got us a vision statement. Woohoo! Parties, balloons, banners, confetti, cake! The next day, what changed? Nothing. Same curriculum, same faculty, thank you. Same students, same courses, same facilities. What changed? Operationally, nothing whatsoever. But not so fast. Everything changed from the perspective of now we're all focused on who we are and what we're doing here. And it didn't necessarily change something that we were teaching or change our curriculum, but it gave us that all-on-board sense of focus. Here we are. We know what we're supposed to be doing. And now we know how all the stuff we've been doing all along all fits into this laser beam focus on who we are. Because a vision statement highlights your identity. So I would propose that even though they don't have that concept of a vision statement in the ancient world, that Genesis 1, in effect, is like a vision statement for the cosmos, because it's helping to focus what the identity is. It's not suggesting that in Genesis 1, operations changed. Maybe not. But focus, role, and purpose, brand new and important. This is what the cosmos is. So create, I would propose, is primarily bringing order, okay? Well, words like make, we read the word God made, and we think certain things in our scientific way of thinking. But in Hebrew, the word make only
designates agency. It doesn't designate what layer or what level of agency. So I would propose that in Genesis, Genesis 1 is not the story about building a house, you know, the construction process that we usually think about. It's about making a home. Those are two different origin stories. Building the house is an origin story. Making a home is an origin story. Building a house is construction. Making a home is ordering. Different ways to think about origins, but both legitimate origin stories. So when we think about building a house, you know, we're talking about the framing, the roof, the foundation, the plumbing, the electricity. Okay, building a house, and it's important. And you can't function as a home until you've built the house. So they're interrelated. But you can tell the building of the house story, or you can tell the making of the home story. They're different. When we have students over our place for dinner, we sit around in one of the rooms, and every once in a while somebody asks us about our place. I can tell you they do not want to know about the plumbing and the air conditioning. They want to know about how we've made this our home. It's an important origin story. Now, in our modern cultural river, creation is a house story. Science is great at house stories, and that's what it is. Science provides the plot to a house story, and so no wonder that when we think of the cosmos in house story terms, we think of science. The house is what you live in, and sometimes we want to know about how that house got constructed, okay? But there's also the home story. The home story is a different sort of origin story. And in the ancient cultural river, creation is a home story. Again, I'm just stating these as propositions. I don't have time to prove them. Okay, but creation is a home story. And here, theology provides the plot. The home story is about the idea that this is our place. God has prepared a place for us. That wasn't new in John 14. I go to prepare a place for you. God has prepared a place for us, so that where I am, you might also be. It's our home, and it's God's home, in relationship, God dwelling among us. That's the theology plot. That's the home story. Home is where your story comes to life. It's not just the place you live in. Okay, full disclosure, I got that from a real estate commercial, but I really like it. It helps. You know, home is where your story comes to life. Okay, so you can see that these are different sorts of narratives. It resolves homelessness. Resolves homelessness. Gives us our identity in our place. Now, these are both important stories, but they're different stories. And we can't dictate to the Bible which one it ought to tell. They tell the one that they think is most important. So which is the most important story? I would contend that for the Bible, home story is most important. And if we're talking our theological understanding of the cosmos, home story is more important. House story has its place. So the cosmos is God's home, it's sacred space. In the ancient world, gods rest in temples. We always wonder, what's this thing about God resting? Well, we don't know that in the ancient world, we do, but I mean, it's not common knowledge that gods rest in temples. And when gods rest in temples, they are not resting on a bed or on a sofa or a recliner. They're resting on the throne. On the throne. God's resting is God's ruling. The temple is the command center of the cosmos. And when he takes up his residence there, it is to rule. I won't go through the theology of rest in the Bible. I've got 3 minutes left. God ceases his ordering activity to now take up his command. We have this in Psalm 132. Look at this. His dwelling place, that's the temple. It's his resting place. His resting place forever, and there he sits enthroned. This is biblical, and it's also very strongly ancient Near Eastern. This is how people think. So God's resting is not his disengagement. Okay, when God rests, the people are the climax of the creation account, but rest is the main goal of creation. We can't talk about the 6 days of creation. Never let that pass your mouth. It's not 6 days of creation. Without the seventh day, it's nothing. God ordered it in 6 days to take up his rule on the seventh day, and that's what it's all about. Okay, resting expresses control over an ordered system, and it is engagement, not disengagement.
It's not leisure, it's not relaxation, it's not naps.
It's engagement. God resolves unrest by giving rest. So, the 7 days. Now we can think differently about the 7 days. Once we think of it as a home story instead of a house story. If it were a house story, we could talk about those 7 days as perhaps referring to the age of the earth. But if it's a home story and not dealing with the material stuff, then this has nothing to do with the age of the earth. Age of the earth is a house story question. If Genesis 1 is a home story, the 7 days don't have anything to do with that. They have to do with temple building. And when they built the temple in the ancient world and in the Old Testament, when the house was totally constructed, the building, then how does it become a temple? That is a place where God dwells among his people. It becomes a temple when God takes up his dwelling there, which takes place both in the Bible and in the ancient Near East in a 7-day inauguration ceremony, inaugurating sacred space, God dwelling among his people. That's what 7 days refer to. So this has nothing to do with the age of the earth. It has everything to do with the nature of God's presence in the temple. He brings order in chapter 1. That's the story they want to tell. Okay? He's not making things in chapter 1. He's the agent bringing about this order in the world. In which case, the 7 days has nothing to do with the age of the earth. You know, if you were to ask the story, if you walked into a play late and it had already begun, you poke the person next to you and say, how did the play begin? He starts and says, well, the play was written in 1934. It was a Pulitzer Prize. No. How did the play begin? Well, that's what I was saying. No. Okay. He says, okay. The set was built by so-and-so construction company, and it was designed for... No. That's not what I want. Well, that's how the play began. No. Well, the cast was chosen. Oh, the costume. No! What's happened since the curtain opened? Oh, why didn't you say so? See, how did the play begin could be answered in a number of different ways. Likewise, the story of origins can be addressed in a number of different ways. Science tells about the building of the set. The Bible's interested in what's happened since the curtain was opened. Thank you.
I'll remind you all to jot down questions you might have for Dr. Walton. Question and answer will be following Robert Bishop's talk. Thank you. You did great.
I'm in the unenviable position of having to follow John Walton, although he did set things up very nicely, because I wanted to say something about multiple ways of knowing. Now, if you know anything about Wheaton College, you know it's a Christian liberal arts college. What it means to be at a liberal arts college is to be at a place that actually tries to honor and respect the fact that there are more ways of knowing than just what we sometimes hear, that, you know, science is the only way of knowing. I'll say something briefly about that in a moment. But the way in which Dr. Walton ended his talk, asking us to think about the fact that an origin story can have many possible, there could be many possible kinds of origin stories when we're thinking about, say, the universe. Those are mapped onto different ways of knowing that can tell us something, or each contribute something in terms of a particular kind of perspective that we might need to take into consideration to build up the full picture, the fullest or broadest, deepest, most complex and rich understanding we can have of the universe. So I'm going to say something just really briefly about that tonight in terms of, on the one hand, theology as a way of knowing and scientific inquiry as a way of knowing. So let me get started on that project. So we live in what I think you can accurately describe as a science-saturated society. Now, that may not always be indicate that, you know, people are walking around thinking about particular sorts of theories like general relativity or quantum mechanics, although those are perhaps, quantum mechanics in particular, things that, you know, get a lot of play on fantasy and sci-fi and those sorts of things. But oftentimes, this science saturatedness is mediated by technology. Right, so as I look around the room, I see some laptop computers out. We've got beamers that are allowing us to be able to see some PowerPoints. We've got remote controls that allow us to be able to control the computer without having to go over and punch a button. Many of you have cell phones, etc., etc. We are used to all kinds of technologies. And technological innovation is happening at what feels like a more and more rapid pace. So you probably just recently, maybe some of you recently upgraded your mobile phones, only to find out a couple of weeks later that you're now out of date. And now you need to spend like $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000, maybe $1,000 more, right, to catch up. So we all feel sort of the press of this as well. And technology is oftentimes the thing that the average person in their daily lives associates most closely with science. And it's hard to deny that as we see technology roll out, that there's something to this science stuff, and we sometimes are puzzled about what to do about that. And I think this is part, it's not the only factor, but it's part of what sort of greases the sled for this thing called scientism, which basically, in a nutshell, is a view that scientific inquiry is the only source of truth or knowledge. It's the only kind of knowledge or truth that counts, and scientific methods are the only methods that can actually give us any kind of trustworthy or reasonable truth or knowledge. Exhaust Rod's patience as moderator with a lengthy discussion about all the ways in which scientism actually impacts and affects us, sometimes in ways that we don't even know it. I'll just make the bold claim, I won't try to prove it here, but one of the desires we have to try and correlate sentences in the Bible as a text with sentences that scientists say has to do with the fact that scientism is in the background, pushing us in the direction of thinking that somehow it's an important project to be able to relate the Bible word for word, perhaps verse for verse, to something in the sciences. To be able to talk about how the Bible addresses or should address the house story instead of the home story in Dr. Walton's terms. On the other hand, our experience in the world is an experience of richness and complexity. It's a kind of experience that when we ask how it is that the sciences, you know, can explain something like our rich experience in the world, that then we begin to come up short. We begin to pause. We begin to, you know, sort of those kinds of things. Something like physics or chemistry or geology or biology, the kinds of subjects that are studied in this building and are taught in this building, don't really have a whole lot to say about the richness and complexity of this experience that we have on a day-in, day-out basis. Indeed, God's good creation is the kind of place, is the kind of world we live in, where we need more than the sciences to be able to understand and grasp what in the world is going on with our world, as well as to be able to get in deeper touch with all of the kinds of, on the one hand, beauty that we experience, as well as, on the other hand, the kinds of tragedy and suffering that is part of the world as well. So we actually need more than just physics. And it doesn't pay me to say that. We need more than physics to be able to grasp, or at least try to get a grasp on the richness and complexity of this world. We need ways of knowing that, and I'll just give you a list of some of the ways of knowing that we need. We need history. We need aesthetics. We need ethics. We need theology. That's the one that oftentimes in our science-saturated world seems perhaps the most surprising to people on the outside. We have to take seriously what comes with personal relationships as we are involved in those. We need to think about spiritual reality, something that physics can't tell us a thing about. So we need all different kinds of ways of knowing. Now, unbeknownst to you, perhaps, you have employed multiple ways of knowing today just to get to this point tonight where you're at this talk. To be able to get up and get out of bed, to shower, to have breakfast, to engage in, hopefully, fruitful, fun, loving conversations with family and friends, etc., etc., etc. You've actually been deploying multiple ways of knowing without perhaps even realizing it. You just go about your day, and you, as the the commercial phrase goes for Nike, you just do it, right? You just do it. It's only when somebody begins to go to a sort of meta level and begin to talk about these things that you suddenly wake up and realize that, oh man, there's more going on than in my life and how I actually understand things and how I deal with things than what I was aware of. And you also hopefully noticed that not all of those things were scientific. So we need multiple ways of knowing. If scientism is true, then all the rich complexity and what we think of as being a meaningful kind, deeply meaningful kind of existence is merely subjective. Or at worst, it really is just kind of meaningless and something really weird is going on that doesn't jive with our everyday sense of the world. And this is the problem of reduction down to scientific inquiry is the only way of knowing. So with that as kind of opening background, I want to say something about how we can make sense of theology as a way of knowing and actually bring it into conversation with scientific inquiry as a way of knowing. And what we do in the book is we focus in particular on the doctrine of creation, and we use that as a kind of theological guidepost. One reason being that in terms of all of the what we talk about being the doctrines of the faith, the doctrine of creation is one that has the most overlap, the closest connection. The best kind of window that opens on to our ability to perhaps see something like scientific inquiry in a kind of balanced perspective. So we used that in the book that in essence is what that little tagline there on In Christian Perspective is actually referring to, how it is that we take seriously the scriptures. We take seriously theological thought that is derived from the scriptures and from our experience of the world and from theological debate over the centuries and try to bring that into close connection with cosmology and geology and chemistry's in there, but we couldn't put chemistry in the title because the marketers thought it was already too long. But somehow if you think, biology has something to do with chemistry. It's in there implicitly. Due apologies to my chemistry colleagues that I see here in the audience. So it's not like we were shorting you. We literally just could not get that in. If we were selling, a million copies every time we wrote a book, we would probably be able to put chemistry in there, but we don't have that kind of power. So we lost that battle. But that's not to say that chemistry is somehow forgotten. Indeed, we have some things to say about how chemistry and theology can be fruitfully related. So let me say something briefly then about the doctrine of creation, since I don't have time to spend about 2 hours kind of laying out the entirety of the doctrine of creation. We focus in particular on a Trinitarian form of the doctrine of creation, which I would argue is what you would derive from taking the whole of the scriptures be able to understand what is the most comprehensive, the most capacious view of the creation and God's relationship to creation and his activity in it. So what does that mean? Think about, for the purposes this evening, just think about the fact that theologians who work on these kinds of questions have identified three different forms of divine mediated activity. One of them is divine command. All of those, let the earth, for example, Genesis 1:24, let the earth, let the eretz, bring forth. And then follows a list of creatures that Dr. Walton could give us a lengthy discussion about why exactly that list functions the way as it does, what's being communicated there. But we've got this whole list of commands in Genesis 1, and so we know that there's something going on in terms of divine command that's connected to things like ordering of the cosmos and its functionality, its purposes, and so forth. Then, second form is what Irenaeus referred to as God's two hands, by which he means the Son and the Spirit, but not in a way where, the Father's up here and the Son and the Spirit are kind of like menial labors. Irenaeus is fully aware that a sound Trinitarian theology has Father, Son, and Spirit as co-equal, co-eternal. But they take up different roles in terms of their theologically economic activity in fulfilling the divine purposes for which they are all on the same page. So when one looks at the scriptures and you begin to see, you notice things in Colossians 1, John 1, Hebrews 1, that all things were created through Christ and are sustained by Christ, superintended by Christ. When you begin to look both at the Old Testament and New Testament at references that either refer directly to the Spirit or draw on biblical images for the Spirit, like wind and water, you see that the Spirit is enabling and energizing all things to be, to have existence, but not just existence, but actually to function in the ways that the Father has called them through divine command to function. And therein we could go and talk a lot about the functional integrity of creation, something that's very important to this understanding of how it is that perhaps we should be thinking, as Dr. Walton was arguing earlier, about what is Genesis 1 telling us about that ordering of the creation. And a third form, and this is the one that is the most absent in mind, I would say, for the contemporary Christian community, and that is the idea that God's action in creation is ministerial through the actual creation that he has made. When you start looking at the parts of creation, you start to notice that they serve in ways in which they enable other parts of creation to be able to do their thing. Quick example is, all of you got here, I should be a little more precise. All of you came into this world in the usual way. Let's put it that way. And the usual way is something that, at least in Psalm 139, is described as God weaving or knitting us together in the womb. Now, when the psalmist is talking about that, the psalmist doesn't know nearly as much about how the biology and the physiology of that works as we do today. But the psalmist also, as probably everybody else in his community, realized that there's something going on. I mean, you can sort of track week by week. At some point, you realize that things are taking place, and you see various kinds of changes, and you begin to feel legs or hands kicking around, so on and so forth. And then birth process, so on and so forth. These were normal, everyday kinds of observations for which they didn't have quite the scientific description that we had, but they realized that something's going on with the human body. So that knitting together in the womb isn't just something that's happening apart from what's going on in the human body. It's happening somehow through what's going on in the human body. That's one way in which we can see this idea that God literally has made a creation to participate in its calling to bring forth, to sustain, to develop. And one can also see that this has something deep to do with the way in which God relates to his world and accomplishes various kinds of purposes in the world. Now, let me give one example of how it is we try to bring the doctrine of creation into a conversation about what's going on in the sciences. And that's via what is a very, very popular, well, popular is probably not the quite the right word to assume. It's a very pervasive false dilemma. It's a kind of false forced choice. Lots of Christians and non-Christians fall into this kind of forced false choice. And you see it in lots and lots and lots of books and articles written by Christian authors and by non-Christian authors. And it takes the following form. The events, things that we see in nature, either are the result of God's unmediated activity in the world, somehow apart from or above the kind of functional integrity, the very order, the properties and processes of nature that God has made. Or they're the result of natural processes just doing their thing without any involvement of God whatsoever. So open up an introductory textbook on astronomy, and you will find at some point an astrophysicist explanation of the formation of galaxies and stars. And we don't know everything that goes into that process, but we know quite a bit about how galaxies form and how stars form. And if you are thinking under the influence of this false dilemma, it looks like you have to say that, but gee, the scientists, right, the astrophysicists, they figured out most of the story for how it is that stars form and how galaxies form. Doesn't seem like there's any room for God in that process whatsoever, so God must not be in that. And the Christian feels a little bit disappointed. And the atheist feels like, see, we don't need God. And then, you know, various sorts of argument takes place, right? But if one is actually thinking about a rich Trinitarian doctrine of creation, we can actually not only see that this is a false dilemma, but we've got some moves that we can make because there are more options on the table. And one way to think about that is by thinking about the fact that we've got this third form of mediated divine activity, where God literally is working through the very forms of order and functionality that he's given to creation, that he is, I would say, graciously gifted to creation to be able to actually bring about things like stars and galaxies. Galaxies, and we wouldn't have stars, and without stars, we wouldn't have planets, and without planets, we wouldn't be here to have this conversation. So there's something you can give a lot of praise for God for right there, before you go to bed this evening. Let's think about an example from Psalm 104. This is almost sort of smack dab in the middle of Psalm 104. You let loose the springs in freshets, among the mountains they go. They water all the beasts of the field, the wild asses slake their thirst. Above them the fowl of the heavens dwell, from among the foliage they send forth their voice. He waters from his loss, from the fruit of your works, the earth is sated. So there's a lot we could say about Psalm 104, but just note a couple of quick points. One, the psalmist is drawing on everyday, ordinary observations that everyone in his community would have been familiar with. So when they heard this psalm, read in the context of worship, they all would have been roughly on the same page. But yeah, I've seen that. Water comes down the mountains in streams and gathers in lakes and ponds, and the wild beasts and the trees are watered by that. They're replenished. They're enabled to grow, to live, to develop, to reproduce, so on and so forth. But at the same time, the psalmist is saying that he, as a God, is the one who waters. Right? So it looks like creation is watering, but God is watering. It's not like the psalmist is schizophrenic. The psalmist is talking about a very deep biblical pattern, that it's always God and creation that are working together to bring about the things that one sees in these natural or, you know, ordinary patterns in the world. Or you could think about when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says that, you know, it's our Father who feeds the birds, and that's, you know, why they don't go hungry, so on and so forth. If you think about, those of you who have bird feeders, enjoy seeing the birds that come and eat the food. Next time you're looking at that, say in the morning, think about the fact that the Father is feeding the birds right there, and I had a role to play in that. But birds, you know, they gather seeds and various sorts. Some eat, pollens. Others do things like, you know, snatch rodents or sorts of critters and eat them. All of that, biblically speaking, is the Father feeding his creatures. So Jesus, like the psalmist, is aware of the fact that the creation is participating in enabling creation to be and do the kinds of things it's called to do, but it's the Father. It's actually God is at work in the midst through that. So to wrap up, I simply say that we can apply the same sort of thought pattern by thinking about the doctrine of creation as the psalmist or Jesus is applying when they are addressing their audiences. And when you think about things like the way in which huge hydrogen gas clouds operating under gravitational attraction begin to form a galaxy, and then in the galaxy, similar kind of process begins to form stars, or even when smaller galaxies merge to form larger galaxies, all these processes that the astrophysicists tell us in quite a bit of detail go on, we can also see that that's actually God's action in creation through the very kinds of processes that God has gifted to creation. And we don't need to think that God's only option is to somehow do a kind of, you know, snap of his fingers from outside the created order to make things happen. And I will stop there because I think it's the time that Rod won his team.
Robert, I'll have you stay up here, and John.
John's on his way down.
Come on down. And I guess maybe the way we should approach this would be, if you did jot down a few questions for John, maybe we'll let the first two or three questions go directly to him. And then after that, if you've got questions specifically for Robert, or questions that both of them could answer, you know, and I'll let you guys know about calling on folks. And we did bring the cigar box back up. If you didn't get a chance to put something in, or if you sat through the lecture and you thought, wow, that was worth a lot more than I was willing to put in the first time, yeah, we'll have that right up here on the front. And you
what about those who want a refund?
Well, we could talk about that. So we'll just put this right up here on the front. If you do want to drop something in on the way out, feel very free to do that. And then also, just hang around for a little while and chat with folks afterwards. And if this just goes on way, way, way too long, I'll come up and interrupt you guys. Otherwise, you guys just take it, okay? So, first questions for Dr. Walton, two or three, and then we'll just jump right in.
My question for you, you talk about Genesis 1 being from non-order to order. But you also mentioned the order is not complete. And you see that in the first 3 days. The darkness is bounded, not illuminated. And the waters, the seas, are being bounded, but not illuminated. But then you go to Revelation on the new earth, there is no seas, and there's no night. So what does that really mean about the difference between the first creation that you study and the next creation?
Well, it certainly means to me that the whole idea is not that we're somehow going to return to Eden. Eden is still in a context where things are not fully ordered. And so God has set it up optimally so that things can operate, but then ordering is supposed to continue on, and it will reach its climax, its fully ordered situation, only in new heavens, new earth. So we're on this trajectory, not a this trajectory, however.
Was Jesus, especially the apostles, were they in the same cultural river that Moses was?
No. There have been a couple sea changes since then. The ancient world that I talk about, the ancient Near East, is the Assyrian, Babylonian, ancient Egyptian world. The Persians come and major sea change with Persian ways of thinking, which is really not like Assyria, Babylonia at all. Then the Greeks come, Alexander the Great, and the Hellenistic sea change is even greater than the Babylonian one, and by the time we get to the New Testament, the Romans have come on the scene, and there's a slight sea change between the Greco-Roman world and the Hellenistic world. So by the time we get to the New Testament, no, it is not the same cultural river, and not that there isn't some overlap, but it's not the same.
Your discussion of rest as divine activity, I'm thinking about the Decalogue in Exodus takes the commandment for Sabbath and connects it to creation. So what does that mean for Sabbath rest for human beings?
Okay, good, thank you. I always leave that out because I know someone will ask. I didn't put it up for that. So if we follow this model that God's rest is on a throne and that means he's ruling, certainly then Exodus is not telling us, so you should work for 6 days and then you should rule on the seventh day, okay? It rather comes to do with the idea that God was ordering. What was his work for the 6 days? It was ordering work. And then he sat down to rule it. What happens for us is that we spend our 6 days of the week trying to bring order to our lives, working to do whatever we can do to bring order to our lives. The seventh day, we are supposed to stop doing that, to recognize that God is the one who brings order to our lives, and that God is the one who needs to be acknowledged as the order bringer. So we rest, we stop, we cease from our work, but then we participate in God's rule. We usually think of it in terms of imitate. I would rather propose that it's participate, setting aside our own ruling, our own ordering, to participate in his rule. And we find that expressed to some extent in Isaiah 58, verses 13 and 14, where it talks not about what you shouldn't do, but what you should do. It's about the only place in the Old Testament where it does that for Sabbath. So that's how I would explain it.
You take a very different view than Hugh Ross. I know that. I like both of you. But anyway, in his history, life history, he was raised in Canada in a non-Christian home and actually studied the various world religions, pointed out that Hinduism talks about a cosmos that recycles itself, which clearly is not consistent with cosmology as we know it. But he also came through the study of the, as he perceived the sequence in the creation texts, multiple texts in the Bible, that led him to believe in the God of the Bible and specifically brought him to Christianity. So this isn't looking at his position now, but what brought him to that position was, in fact, the biblical text, which is a very different position than you take.
And, you know, we're very grateful that God can work through all sorts of ways to bring us to himself. God frequently works through, I'm not suggesting it's about Hugh, but works through misinterpretation of passages, and people come to faith anyway. And that doesn't kind of take away the validation. For instance, there's the verse in Revelation 3, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." And many people were presented with the gospel that challenged it. Christ stands at the door, and will you open and let him in? Okay, and many people were saved through that kind of message. But it's very clear in Revelation, this is a message to the churches, to people who are already saved. And that's not what that verse is talking about. But yet, people come to Christ through that, and that's great. God can do that. But the fact that God uses those kinds of things doesn't validate those conclusions. Okay? So it's wonderful that God brought Hugh to himself and the great ministry that Hugh has had. But again, you can't use that as a validation.
I do.
Let me suggest that we'll just open it up at this point, but if you have further questions for Dr. Walton, go ahead.
This could be for either. First of all, I tried to hang on every word you said. Dr. Walton, your presentation of ideas is superb. And it makes me wonder if there might be a sequel and whether it might take the form of when Jesus came and ministered to us around 4 BC to 40 AD, whether a new creation is in order and what that might look like with the framework you have so masterfully started to put together.
Well, it may be, but I have to leave that to my New Testament colleagues. I'm outside of my training there, and I try not to meddle in other people's disciplines. But it may well be that there are some important things there to put together.
I have a question for Robert. The third form that you have up there, where did that come from? Is that relatively new, or is that also Irenaeus?
No, you actually find that beginning to be developed in sort of late 2nd, 3rd century by some of the early church pastor theologians. Irenaeus focuses more on the role of the Son and the Spirit.
So it's not an outgrowth of the ecological movement, or this is the
this predates them by centuries, although the ecological movement could probably take a page or two from some of the thinking in the first 3 or 4 centuries of the church.
You had on one of your slides the words God's unmediated intervention. How does that compare to God's mediated intervention? I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah, so the contrast in terms of the let me go back to this slide here. The contrast between unmediated and mediated. So mediated forms of intervention are, well, actually intervention is not even the right word there because it gets misleading, but in terms of mediated activity, to mediate something means that, mediate an action means that it takes place through some mediator. Right, so sort of quick example, we are told in Exodus, maybe also in Numbers, that Moses built the temple. Right, built the tabernacle. Right, but when you look at what's going on in the story about Exodus, it's clear that he built it through a whole bunch of means. He had artisans. He had skilled craftspeople who were shaping and making and weaving and dyeing, and people were bringing, collecting materials and bringing them, so on and so forth. So when Moses builds the tabernacle, he's not the one who's doing all the work. He somehow is doing it through all of these various means. Summary with Joseph. Joseph went through all of Egypt and collected all the grain. Well, he must have done that, right, via lots of people who built the storehouses and, you know, all these different regional centers and helped collect the grains to store them there and so on and so forth. Right, so there's a couple of examples of ways we can see that. What does it mean for somebody to do something in a mediated fashion, to be able to actually do it through various sorts of means? And when you look at Psalm 104, you see that there are all kinds of ways in which shelter is provided, and food is provided, and water is provided through all these natural means. They look like the sort of things that we're kind of used to seeing, it, unless you spent your entire life in the city, right? Then you might not grasp quite the power, the import of Psalm 104. That pattern reflects something you see in Genesis 24 and 25. You know, God said, "Let the earth, let the arids bring forth, let it originate all these different kinds of creatures." Then verse 25 says, "So God made," right? It's both. And in a way where there's clear separation between creator and creature, that never gets confused. So there are no pantheists in the Bible.
And that's that agency element that I was talking about.
Yeah,
The idea that God is the agent, but that agency can take very many different roles in terms of levels of mediation or direct or indirect connection. But the important part the Bible always stresses is that God is the agent, no matter how all of that works out.
Right, so an example of what it means to be unmediated would mean to come through or to take place in a way that doesn't come through any of those sort of normal, everyday, ordinary means like laws of nature or so on and so forth.
Just say God's direct intervention?
That gets tricky because when you look at Psalm 104, it looks like he's pretty directly involved in all of these processes, like gravity, bringing water down to places where it forms its boundaries, and its boundaries are turn out to be things like river troughs, riverbeds, and lakes and ponds. We have a pretty good physics explanation for why gravity actually provides this boundary for the waters that they won't cross back over unless you really disturb the system a lot, like a hurricane. Come in, right? We should pray for people all along the eastern coast, definitely. It's clearer to speak in terms of unmediated intervention, something that comes from outside. I mean, an example of that would be Jesus' resurrection. Right? So far as we know, there are no biological resurrection principles out there. Am I right about that, Jenny? So our biologist is shaking her head. Yes. This is something that definitely comes from outside the system. And that is a kind of example of an unmediated intervention. And the point of this false dilemma is that when we find ourselves trapped in thinking God can only do miracles that somehow violate the laws of nature, or it's just nature doing its thing, then we've taken the wrong exit off the interstate. We have left behind the very perspective that we find in the psalmist in Psalm 104, in Genesis 1, and Job, and many other biblical texts. And our suggestion in the book is that if we take those sort of biblical images and patterns seriously, in terms of the doctrine of creation, we can see the sciences and all the things that the sciences do in a different light. Than the kind of dark shadows that are cast by this false dilemma. That was a long-winded. But one way to keep this question short is to basically spend the entire question time answering one question. It's technique.
God's action in creation is ministerial. Ministerial sounds like really nice. Someone's taking care of something else. But what about disease? What about mutation? Things that kill organisms? Is that part of God's creation as being ministerial?
That's an excellent question. And one that I think sort of should, eventually sort of naturally sort of bubbles up as you begin to think about what's going on in this view. And it's, I think, you have there are various ways in which you have to face that question if you take seriously the Bible's view that God is the key agent in all that's happening. So we think about this this idea of, well, two key ideas. One is incompleteness. When we look in Genesis 1, as Dr. Walton was clarifying, it's not a picture of a perfect, completed, finished creation. We only get little glimpses of the perfect created or completed creation in terms of when the Bible talks about the new creation, the new heavens and earth. So there's something incomplete, unfinished, and part of that sort of ending promise commission to go forth and multiply and to subdue the earth has to do with this participating in this ordering process, as Dr. Walton was talking about. And that's not finished yet. So we've got that piece on the table. But the other piece on the table is the fact that, that there's this disruption. There's this disorder, there's this evil that has broken in. And evil doesn't necessarily mean that, there was perhaps, I mean, we don't know for sure, but that there were perhaps no, say, earthquakes before Adam and Eve had their little incident with the serpent and the fruit, or that there weren't hurricanes, or that there weren't tornadoes, because we know now that things like hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes are indelibly related to the fact that we have a liquid core planet, and liquid core planets are, the best possible kinds of planets for sustaining life in terms of supporting atmospheres and having appropriate sort of temperature ranges, and when you're around a sun in the or a star in the habitable zone and so forth. But if you're going to have a liquid core planet, you're going to have crust that actually does these very interesting sort of breakups and plowing underneath and uplifting, and that's going to cause earthquakes from time to time and so on. For disease, though, so think about something like cancer. Cancer actually works very well to minister to itself. The things that we've learned about cancer are actually, to a person like me, they're really quite scary, because the way in which cancer cells are able to marshal resources of the body and to be able to support one another to grow and sustain and fend off the body's immune system are downright scary, but it's actually co-opting. It's a way in which you can see it's actually co-opting the ministerial nature of all sorts of biological and cellular processes and twisting them, turning them in a direction that leads to death instead of one that leads to life, one that leads towards, perhaps one could say disorder, but at least to non-order as opposed to moving towards more and more order. So I suggest, there are ways in which we might be able to reframe how we think about disease and other things. And ultimately, we probably have to sort of think about it. If we're going to take the full doctrine of creation as laid out in the scriptures seriously.
Okay. Is it possible that we still keep, or I still keep wanting sequels? And one of them that might be possible, and I'd appreciate your comment, what about Satan, good old Satan, and what kind of role is that a being, and what are we fighting against?
I have a book coming out in maybe May or June called Demons and Spirits in Biblical Theology. And that will address that significantly.
There's your sequel. Right there.
Wow.
The only thing I would add to that is the Bible doesn't say a whole lot about, new heavens and new earth, what this new creation is. But one of the things that seems to be clear in Revelation is that evil and disorder is not there. It's gone. It's absent. And that could imply that somehow, Satan is not in the picture, or perhaps some kind of transformation has happened. But we don't know. All we can do is speculate that. But he won't be a player in the new creation. I think there was a hand that was sort of coming up about the same time.
I think it goes along with this discussion about disruption and disorder. The question is sometimes raised in terms of death before the fall. Was there such a thing as death that was happening within creation prior to the fall?
We happen to have an expert on that topic.
Since I don't see anything that suggests there wasn't, I assume there was. Some people think that they would say there was no death before the fall because the Bible says it was good. But we have to take that good in accordance with the context in the Hebrew usage. It's not the word for perfect. It's not the word for, you know, kind of morally ideal. It's a word for functioning properly and therefore ordered properly. So that would not rule out that there was death before the fall. Sometimes we look at Romans 5 and we say, well, Paul seems to suggest that, you know, death only comes in after sin, that we are subject to death because of sin. But Paul's not suggesting that there was, that people were created immortal. He knows better, because he knows that there is a tree of life in the garden. And a tree of life is not needed by people who are immortal. But rather, in the garden, they had a remedy. The tree of life was an antidote for their mortality. And so when they sinned and they lost access to the tree of life, they were then subject to death. And so we are subject to death because of sin. So likewise, that doesn't suggest that there was no death prior to the fall. And again, if the Bible doesn't suggest there was no death, then in fact it does say that man is dust. And then it explains to us that dust you are, to dust you shall return. Dust is an image of mortality, as the Bible uses it. And we were dust before the fall. So again, all the indication is that there was death and mortality prior to the fall. Now, of course, that makes some trickiness for working out sin and salvation, but it's workable trickiness.
So let me offer an opportunity for one more question, perhaps. And before I do that, let me mention that we will be convening again here later on this fall. Do you remember, is it in November?
It's in November.
November sometime. If you're on the mailing list, we'll definitely get you a notice about that. And it'll be some of the other authors from this upcoming book on origin issues. So time for one more question. And again, thanks everybody for coming out.
Dan.
I have a question for either one or both of you. And it's a pedagogical one. You know, as I'm sure you all imagine, that a lot of the ideas that you put forward here are foreign to our cultural river that we all swim in. And I'm wondering if you were to pick just a handful of most important ideas to present to children, kindergarten through sixth grade, as they are in the Sunday school classroom, you know, learning about the early chapters of Genesis, have you done any thinking about how would you best present these ideas or frame the scriptures that they're reading so that they don't grow up, you know, swimming in a cultural river that they're, you know, that leads them to a completely different understanding of the text that they're studying?
Well, in Sunday school, I want to give them the theological punch of the Bible. And that means that, from my understanding of the text, I would want to talk about the way that God has ordered our world. And kids at a very young age can understand that concept. You know, they can talk about how their parents help order their schedule in their house and home and things of that sort. And so the idea that God is ordering this world to work for us, and it's God's ordering it to dwell with us. I mean, those are basic theology. And so I would approach young children by talking about the positive theology of the text that we often miss because we're too interested in the sciences.
Now, eventually, they're going to ask about dinosaurs. You know, we got to get into that. But that's how I would approach it. That is, identity remains a very important issue today. And to talk about what the cosmos is, what the universe is, and what we are as people, because that's where I would go with Genesis 2 as well. It's about human identity. We're dust, and we are gendered, and we are different from the animals, and we are people in the presence of God. Identity. So I think those are the theological issues, and those are what I would try to teach.
Let's thank our presenters again.